Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdaa al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaa.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed Imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed, that a divinely appointed Imam must have the most knowledge and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabih at-tuja wa a'lam at-tuqa wa dawin nuha.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thought, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's prophet, and the progeny of Allah's messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ.
Peace be upon the imams, the leaders, the guides, the chiefs, the authorities, the defenders, the protectors, the people of the reminder, the men in authority, the left ones by Allah, his select, his party, the case of his knowledge, his argument, his path, his light, his proof.
Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, this divinely appointed imam from the household of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. So there's this very beautiful conversation that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam has with one of his companions. And it's interesting. The companion was kind of asking about various different things, and eventually we find that in responding to the companion, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he starts to talk about these very central and universal, I guess, realities, if you will. The beauty about the divinely appointed imams is that, you know, they spoke in such a profound manner, and their words themselves were so profound, you know, and I guess it's something that's not too strange when you take into consideration the fact that they were connected with the Almighty Allah, and the Almighty Allah, of course, being the source of knowledge and wisdom. So this is, you know, it's not strange that they said such profound and immaculate words. And so we find that in this conversation, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he says that the ways that Allah has forbidden are the ways of Iblis, the ways of Shaitan, and the promise of eternal bliss is that which is in paradise. You know, and even though this conversation continues, but even these two small statements are something which are really profound, you know. They're something that one can really reflect and think upon, and it is an interesting reality of the universe and of the cosmos. This idea that, you know, the ways that Allah has forbidden are the ways of Iblis, the ways of Shaitan. And so, you know, who is Shaitan? Shaitan, of course, is this rebel who has rebelled, who has transgressed against the commandments of the Almighty Allah in a very brazen and overt manner. You know, when despite praying and worshiping Allah for thousands of years, you know, when it came to a serious test and when it came to paying obeisance to Prophet Adam alayhi salam, we find that Shaitan openly and brazenly he opposed the Almighty Allah and opposed him, you know, right in his face, metaphorically speaking. You know, it wasn't something that was very hidden or very internal. No, it was quite brazen and arrogant. So this idea that the ways of shaitan are the ways that Allah has forbidden all of us from doing, you know, and it kind of, you know, lets you understand and lets you realize that Allah does not forbid things for no reason. The reason that Allah forbids us from certain things is because they are ways which lead to humiliation and shame and down this dark path in which there is only pain and suffering involved. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Hadi, alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In the Great Mosque of the Old City of Sana'a, the Yemeni Scholars Association convened a meeting calling for the nation's scholars to fulfill their role in the Al-Aqsa Fluid Battle and the ensuing victory. The event saw a significant turnout of Yemeni scholars.
Our message to the scholars who have shirked their responsibility to support Gaza is to fear God, for that will expose them to God's punishment in this world and the hereafter. Silence regarding what our brothers endure in Gaza amounts to participating in the Zionist enemy's crimes against children and women. The people will also justify their silence with the silence of their scholars and rulers. Therefore, their sin is greater than that of the rest of the people.
The participants criticized the inaction of Muslim scholars regarding the atrocities in Gaza, labeling it the genocidal war by Israel. They emphasized the scholars' profound responsibility, asserting their religious duty to support their Palestinian brothers. They argued that the current situation in Palestine is the consequence of decades of silence.
The responsibility of the scholars is great, as they are the ones who can move the streets and the people, and they can compel the rulers to act with the fatwa or word from them in support of Gaza.
Since the onset of the war on Gaza, Yemeni scholars have actively participated in weekly demonstrations supporting Palestine and have encouraged public demonstrations in solidarity. Furthermore, the Scholars Association has declared its support for the Yemeni military's naval operations targeting Israeli maritime activities and its allies.
Yemeni scholars assert that the normalization deals between Arab countries and Israel have emboldened the regime to continue its oppressive campaign against Palestinians. They urge all Muslim scholars to advocate for Palestine, regardless of their government's possessions. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani will meet with U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington on April 15 for talks on the U.S. military presence in the Arab country. Also, a range of other issues, including the fight against Daesh and the ongoing Iraqi financial reforms, will be discussed.
The demands of Iraqi nation and political blocs will be taken to Washington by the prime minister. We all know there is a large consensus in the country to end the foreign forces' presence. The prime minister will also discuss the economic situation and challenges, most importantly, the U.S. dollar exchange rates, which have been affecting the market since the imposition of sanctions by U.S. Treasury on Iraqi banks.
In January, Baghdad and Washington began formal talks about ending the coalition mission purportedly formed to help the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. After the defeat of Daesh in 2017 by Iraqi anti-terror forces, the U.S. still stationed some 2,500 troops in Iraq and 900 in neighboring Syria as a part of the coalition mission.
It's time for the government to end the coalition mission. It's the demand of the Iraqi people. We all agree that these forces have gone too far, violating our sovereignty, so today we witnessed a call by the Iraqi nation that the time has come for these forces to leave.
Following the parliamentary decision in 2020, Iraqi authorities have agreed for drawing up a timeline to end the presence of foreign forces, which proved by action to be a threat to the country's stability. Iraqi nation agrees that foreign forces' presence is no longer necessary, and the prime minister will carry their demands to Washington. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
Salman Qasimi, an Islamic school teacher, says it's an unprecedented move in India to ban madrasas instantly, calling it a blow to marginalized Muslim families across India's most populous state of Uttar Pradesh. He says lives of thousands of families are directly dependent on such institutions, while the government of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi accuses them of receiving illegal funding. Scholars argue such institutions are building blocks of Islamic teachings across the country, which regular schools can't do.
This judgment is unfortunate. We respect the court decision, but we oppose it. Our constitution allows us to have such schools to teach Islamic values to future generations. If this is against secularism, why it was made in the first place? Every citizen can read, write, promote or propagate their religion. That's what our constitution says. Madrasa's instant closure is a blow to livelihood of thousands of families.
In January, the government of Uttar Pradesh state halted a funding program for madrasas, leaving more than 20,000 teachers unemployed. Scholars say Friday's verdict applies to all Islamic schools in the state that are privately and government funded. In recent months, India's northeastern state of Assam converted hundreds of madrasas into conventional schools.
All the laws and all the things which are BJP is enacting or BJP is targeting the Muslim community, definitely they think that the if they want to rule the country, so they can rule the country when they can demonize Muslim community, they can suppress Muslim community, they can make them wetless at the time of election. So all these efforts are taking place because of the RSS background, RSS agenda of the present ruling party.
In recent months, Modi's government turned down new proposals from the states and halted payments to schemes that would finance Muslim schools. Critics say this amounts to snatching the livelihood of thousands of families instantly, while they have no other means of earning.
India will hold general elections in a few weeks' time, and the BJP's victory is imminent, according to observers. Activists and rights groups have accused the governing party of promoting anti-Islamic rhetoric in a deliberate attempt to appease the majority voters by polarizing the voters, therefore using divide and rule policy to win the elections.
Rights groups have accused the BJP government of persecuting and intimidating Muslims through all possible means. The accusation BJP rejects, saying India is a vibrant democracy enshrined in equality for all. Critics accuse the ruling party of systematic repression against the largest minority group, including hate crimes, mob lynching and cow vigilantism amid rising Islamophobia. Observers say such issues pave the way for Prime Minister Modi to remain in office for a third consecutive term. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Pakistan has joined the global celebrations of a very special Nowruz that has coincided with the holy month of Ramadan. Noroz, which translates to New Day, is celebrated by millions of peoples worldwide as the Persian New Year, symbolizing rebirth, renewal, and arrival of spring.
To all my fellow Pakistanis celebrating Noroz, I say let's cherish our cultural diversity and come together in solidarity. May this new year bring us prosperity, peace, and happiness.
Despite its Persian origins, Noroz in Pakistan is celebrated with a distinctive local flavor, incorporating regional traditions and customs. Pakistanis have their own customs to welcome Noroz. Besides preparing special meals and decorating the dining area with special dried and fresh fruits, the ancient occasion also creates an opportunity for individuals to mend broken ties, forgive others, let go of the past, and build stronger relationships in the coming new year.
For me, Noroz is a time of reflection and renewal. It's a reminder to leave behind the past year's troubles and embrace the opportunities that lie ahead. It's a celebration of life, growth, and the beauty of nature.
We clean our house, we visit our friends, we celebrate this day, we enjoy a lot of festive foods, and you know, this day brings a lot of joy and happiness in our lives. So, happy Noroz to all of you.
Pakistan's President Asif Ali Zardari and Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif have extended their heartfelt greetings to all those who are celebrating Noroz in Pakistan and around the world. Both leaders also called for embracing the spirit of Noroz and promoting the message of peace, compassion, unity, and kindness.
Noroz signifies regeneration at the start of a new cycle. It transcends simple festivity, standing as a cultural landmark that enhances the diversity of human society. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
After weeks of silence, Kitab Hezbollah Resistance Group, one of the biggest units within Iraq's popular mobilization units, reminds the government, as well as officials in the committee tasked with overseeing the withdrawal of U.S. military, that they should not grant immunity to the occupying forces, or else gates of hell will open.
These foreign forces have been violating our sovereignty for years now. In January 2020, Donald Trump ordered the assassination of our anti-terror commanders, Lieutenant General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad airport. And lately, they are violating it by assassination of Iraqi resistance commanders.
Kitab Hezbollah also warned that any removal of leaders of popular mobilization units must be decided by the PMU internally. It says acting otherwise would be a significant mistake.
Our government has made it clear on multiple occasions that the need for U.S. military forces have ended. Our security forces are capable of running the country's security system and face any threat. Washington is clearly trying to rally around the negotiations, and it is a clear attempt to delay their withdrawal from the country.
In January, the Iraqi resistance decided to halt the attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria. The attacks were started on October 19 in solidarity with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Observers say that the suspension was to allow a climate of serenity for talks between Baghdad and Washington over the U.S. military presence. But as some have rightly noted, Washington has no intention to change its behavior in Iraq.
It is obvious that Washington is trying to gain more time to keep its military presence in Iraq. Our government needs to push forward and speed up the pace of negotiations to end the presence of these foreign forces and save our country's political, economic, and social stability.
On paper, the U.S. military forces are present in the country for advisory purposes, as well as training the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. However, in practice, the U.S. forces have shown a different objective by violating Iraqi sovereignty, attacking PMU positions, and killing top Iraqi commanders. Since the start of their operations in October, the resistance in Iraq has been pushing the government to end the U.S. military presence in the country. Also, they have time and again reiterated their solidarity with Palestinians. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
Russian President Vladimir Putin addressed the nation after the deadly attack in Moscow, which killed dozens of civilians. The president denounced the massacre as a bloody and barbaric terrorist attack, as he declared March 24, a National Day of Mourning. At least 11 suspects, including four perpetrators who directly participated in the shooting spree, have been arrested. The four direct perpetrators were detained in Bryansk region. According to the intelligence service, the terrorists planned to cross the Russian-Ukrainian border. The Russian president vowed to punish all involved in the massacre.
All the perpetrators, organizers, and customers of this crime will suffer fair and inevitable punishment, whoever they are, whoever guides them. I repeat, we will identify and punish everyone who stands behind the terrorists, who prepared this atrocity, this attack on Russia, on our people.
The Daesh Takfiri terror group claimed responsibility, but Moscow has dismissed the claim, asserting that investigation is still underway to ascertain the main culprits. Russia's security service says the Moscow attackers had contacts in Ukraine supporting them. During interrogation, a detained terrorist said he was promised 5,000 rubles to carry out the terrorist attack. He claimed he watched a certain preacher on Telegram, and allegedly his assistant contacted the man.
The perpetrators are ignorant, illiterate people who will commit any crime for money. The question is different. Where is the planning center? Not a single international organization can act in the international arena, especially in a state like Russia, where there are strong power structures. Performers can be found anywhere through the agents. We went through this experience in Chechnya. This once again convinces us that international terrorist structures are the work of the CIA and Western intelligence services.
The attack, which came amid Ukraine's war with Russia, was the deadliest in the country since the Beslan school siege in 2004. After Friday's attack, Putin held discussion with his Belarusian counterpart Alexander Lukashenko. Both leaders confirmed their readiness to work together in the fight against terrorism.
In his address, President Putin said Moscow attackers were preparing to flee towards Ukraine, where a window had been prepared for them with the help of Ukraine. Now it remains to be seen how Russia is going to react to the massacre, which came in a very volatile region and amid its war against Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Syrians used to say, no one sleeps hungry, but that was 13 years before the devastating terrorist war that was waged upon them, the war that has pushed many Syrians below the poverty line. SAID is an association that has been helping these people by providing daily meals to the needy during the fasting month for over a decade. Despite the increasing challenges, they are determined to continue with their mission.
We're currently operating a kitchen called Hunger Be Gone. Unfortunately, our resources this year are less than previous years due to the circumstances the country has been through, such as the earthquake disaster that drained a lot of financial resources. We distribute around 200 to 250 meals every day to the people who come to the association, while our motorcycle team also delivers meals to remote areas.
As a chef, I start every day at 9 a.m. by preparing the water and cooking the chicken for the scheduled meal. I have been volunteering for 5 years to help my fellow countrymen in these difficult circumstances.
Syrians have demonstrated their sense of responsibility in various ways during this crisis, particularly during the month of Ramadan. The Holy Month of Mercy encourages people to be selfless and to help alleviate the sufferings of others. Voluntary work is one of the ways through which Syrians showcase their contributions to society.
So we are here not only to donate financially, but to donate our time more specifically. Volunteering is something very important, especially for our generation. We need to teach people that giving doesn't always mean that you need to take something in return. So we're here to volunteer with our time, to try to help people as much as we can. So SAID Association is our vessel to do that.
Today we came to make meals for the people in need. First we cut the vegetables, then we shredded the chicken, and now we are cooling down the rice and the chicken. Then we're gonna put it in boxes and give it to people in need.
Despite the United States' theft of their resources and the inhuman sanctions imposed upon them, which have put Syrians in dire living conditions, they steadfastly hold on to their love for their country, united against all the odds. They strive to find their way through this dark tunnel towards the dawn of a brighter life.
Syrians have always firmly stood together, not only against terrorism, but also in the face of unjust Western sanctions, through voluntary initiatives that show their love to each other and to their homeland. Ibrahim Wahid, Damascus.
Since the Al-Aqsa flood operation and the Israeli genocidal aggression against Gaza began early October last year, Hezbollah has taken a stance of defense against Israeli military targets near Lebanon's southern border. Now, months later, a propaganda campaign has been launched against such efforts, with social media posts and bulletin boards across the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and beyond reading slogans such as "Implementing international resolutions enhances stability" or "Lebanon does not want war." If you asked all Lebanese whether they would want an Israeli war to begin in Lebanon, the unanimous response would be no, especially with decades of experience with the Israeli regime and its disproportionate targeting of civilians. Yet what seems like a simple billboard has deeper implications for a country like Lebanon. Experts tell Press TV that certain groups in Lebanon have launched this campaign to put people against the resistance at a time of war. But are these factions working alone?
This campaign, we can say that it doesn't represent the Lebanese people. And especially in that it is, and we have information, it is funded by foreign countries.
Those parties and those factions, they were controlled by the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. The U.S. Ambassador, Dorshi Shea, as she was departing Beirut and also receiving her successor, Lisa Johnson, they were working on this in a way that would, help Amos Hochstein and his pressures put on Lebanon.
Hochstein, who is an Israeli-American businessman and lobbyist, has gone back and forth from Beirut to Tel Aviv in attempts to stop the resistance operations, without any mention of an end to Israeli violations of Lebanon's rights, which have persisted for over 17 years.
By supporting the resistance in Gaza or in Palestine, the resistance in Lebanon have prevented war. It didn't start the war. And especially when the Lebanese people and the Palestinian people and the Iraqi people and all people in the world are not protected by the international decisions.
Some people inside Lebanon, they are working as agents of the Americans and the Zionists, unfortunately, trying to accuse Hezbollah and the resistance of false things, misinformation, though it is crystal clear that the resistance is trying to protect Lebanon.
With growing popular support and despite the pressure from foreign and domestic sides, Hezbollah has been adamant on proceeding with its supportive military operations as long as the Israeli onslaught against Gaza continues. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب الله.
The Limelight.
Since the war began in Gaza in October, approximately 2 million Palestinians have been displaced from the north to the south. Of these, an overwhelming body of research documented Palestinian civilians being bombed, shot at, executed, arrested, tortured, treated in a degrading manner, and forcibly disappeared by the Zionist regime military along roads, corridors, and zones declared safe. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Sohila was alone in her apartment when the Zionist regime began its genocidal war on October 7th. All she could hear were the sounds of explosions. All she could do was pray for the people being martyred. Before returning to Gaza a few years ago, Sohila had spent a decade in Egypt. She came back as she wanted to see her nephews and nieces. Little did she know the horrors that would await her. A 63-year-old wheelchair user, Sohila lived in Sheikh Radwan area of Gaza City. She remained there after the Zionist regime ordered everyone in northern Gaza, including Gaza City, to leave their homes during the early days of the war. The situation in Sheikh Radwan became increasingly serious, especially after the Zionist regime sent tanks into the area. Israel showed no mercy toward children or older people. The violence got closer and closer to Sohila's apartment. All she could hear were explosions, the siren sound from ambulances, people screaming. The noises were so loud and intense that she thought she would go deaf. When a lull took place, Sohila heard her door being knocked. A voice called, "Is there anyone there?" She replied, "Yes, I am here." Her voice was weak and she could not raise it. The knocking on her door continued and Sohila kept saying, "I am here." She managed to get into her wheelchair. A short while later, the door burst open. A man appeared. He asked, "Are you the only one in this apartment?" She said, "Who are you?" The man explained that he was a civil defense worker. He told her that she needed to get out of the apartment quickly. The whole block, he added, was about to be targeted by the Zionist regime. Sohila was shocked and angry at the news, but suppressed her emotions. She asked the civil defense worker to help her get two thobs from her closets. And she bid a hasty farewell to her apartment. She was brought to Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. She went to stay with relatives there. Her relatives' home was not adapted for someone using a wheelchair. Sohila needed help going to the bathroom. She depended on her relatives for food and water. Sohila did not stay long in Khan Yunis. Not long after her arrival, the Zionist regime began bombarding the city, forcing a large-scale evacuation. She headed with her relatives to Rafah, further south. Unfortunately, she became separated from them amid a general commotion. Alone on Rafah's streets, Sohila had no idea what to do or where to go. A young man came to her and brought her to a mosque. Sohila took shelter in the mosque. At the mosque, Sohila became quiet, agitated. A volunteer nurse named Sama noticed that her health was worsening. When Sohila was offered food, she refused it. In her distressed state, she accused others in the mosque of trying to kill her. On one occasion, Sohila agreed to eat a little after hours of persuasion. She asked for an apple and some chocolate, but neither of those could be found. If they were still available in the markets, they were too expensive for people taking shelter to afford. Early one morning, she had a burst of energy. She requested to visit the bathroom and to change her clothes. Suddenly, she started vomiting. An ambulance came and took her away. On the way to the hospital, she died. No funeral was held. Some people may attribute her death to natural causes, or her age, or illness. But we are convinced she was tormented and died because of sorrow. She died in a strange place. She was hungry and thirsty and had nobody from her family around her.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadamiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahruddin was...
When we say Divan of Hafiz is a book of Irfan...
Maulavi claims that this Masnavi Ma'navi is the interpretation of the Qur'an.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly life of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries, ulama and scholars all across the world of Islam during the history of Islam. For today's discussion, I have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sheikh Fadai. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Fadai, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
All right, for today's discussion, we want to talk about another outstanding figure and faqih, a mujtahid and mutakallim, Shiite one, of course, from India again. He is no one but Sayyid Ali Naqvi or Sayyid Dildar Ali Naqvi. Sheikh Rouhani, give us some details about this outstanding man from India, a Shiite one. Who was he exactly?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Dildar Ali Naqvi or Sayyid Ali Naqvi is a faqih, a jurist and theologian, a Shiite theologian from India, who was known in India as Ghufran Ma'ab.
Yes.
Of course, he studied in Najaf al-Ashraf and also in Mashhad, in the presence of the great scholars like Bahrul Ulum, Sahib Riyaz, Mirza Mahdi Shahristani. And of course, he had the permission of narrating riwayat of Ahl al-Bayt from Sayyid Mahdi Khurasani and Mirza Mahdi Shahristani. So that's why he was among the mujtahid At the beginning of his scholarly life, he was akhbari maslak, traditionist.
Yes.
But later he turned to usuli and, let's say, the principialist, we can say.
Yes.
And that's why he is among the founders of the school of usuli in India by mm-hmm. the book titled as Asasul Usul.
Yes.
That's why he played a great role in campaigning against the Akhbariyun or traditionists in India. Yes, of course. Yes. Okay. Another point that could be mentioned about his scholarly life is that he is among the offspring of Imam Al-Hadi,
yes,
the 10th infallible Imam.
Thank you very much. So again, Sheikh Fadai, we have a figure that struggled very much in order to spread Shiite Islam in India, especially Usuli Maktab in India. Just talk a little bit for us about his scholarly life in over there in India, especially in Lucknow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Ali Naqvi, as my brother mentioned, was born in India, but in order to use from great scholars of Shia Hoza, he had a journey to Iraq and could use from his great professors, Ayatollah Wahid Behbahani, Sahib Riyaz, Sayyid Bahrul Ulum, and Sayyid Muhammad Mahdi Khorasani after that in Iran. It means that he had two journeys to Iraq and Iran in order to use the knowledge of his professors. That is a very important point in his life that we can see this point even in other scholars' life, that they tolerate the hardship of journeys even at that time when the yes. journeys were not easy. They tolerated that in order to improve their knowledge, improve the science, and then transmit it to other people. And after being in the classes of his great scholars, he could have ijaza of rivaya. You know, at that time, before Usuli, the yes. school of thought, usually our scholars, mostly they were focused on rivaya.
Yes.
So because rivaya was the only source of deriving the rules of Islam from religion,
yes.
They were more sensitive about rivaya.
Yes.
And because of that, there was some certificate uh-huh. called ijazat or rivaya.
Yes.
It means that all people, all scholars and Hoza students were not allowed to say and write rivaya.
Yes.
They had to get this certificate. In order, it means that they have to reach a level.
Mm-hmm.
So at that level, they were allowed to say and write rivaya in their book. He had ijazat al-rivaya from all three great scholars that he had.
So this ijazat al-rivaya was different from ijazat al-ijtihad, you mean?
Yes, that is different.
Okay.
Ijazat al-rivaya right. means that you are allowed to say that our imams said
uh-huh.
that.
This and that.
So
it needs a specific knowledge.
Yeah, specific knowledge.
And authenticity.
But
that's right.
after the time of, after this time, I mean, when the school of Usuli appeared
yes.
at that time, this ijaza changed to ijazatul ijtihad.
Mm-hmm.
Because in ijtihad, rivaya is not the only source. We use from rivaya, we use from Quran, we use from aql, we use from ijma. We have four sources. So ijazatul ijtihad is something greater than ijazatul rivaya. But before the time of Usulis, we didn't have anything called ijazat al-ijtihad, only ijazat al-rivaya. I mean, at his time, he could get that certificate, ijazat al-rivaya, and he was able to get that from three great scholars, Sahib Riyaz, Sayyid Bahrul Ulum,
yes.
and Sayyid Muhammad Mahdi Khorasani, and that is a great achievement
That's
for
right.
a scholar.
Nice point and nice differentiation between ijazat al-ijtihad and ijazat al-rivaya. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Shaykh Rouhani, some of his achievements in India were really great. For example, establishing Salat al-Jum'ah in Lucknow and Salat al-Jama'ah in Lucknow by him leading by a Shiite one over there among his achievements. Let's explain a little bit about this.
Yes, as you know, unfortunately, the colonizers sometimes supported anti-Shiite kind of teachings, doctrines, and schools. As we mentioned in the life of Sayyid Lucknowi as well, that the Britain, let's say, queen ordered the people not to say azan, in the azan, ashadu, the shahada of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. So you see that, unfortunately, these sort of problems sometimes were there for the Shiite communities.
Yes.
One of the great things that, great achievement that made by this scholar, as you rightly mentioned, was the Qiyam, or resistance for having the Jum'ah prayer for the Shiite community. So that's why, of course, it was one of the great achievement of this Shiite scholar, because it is the Salatul Jum'ah, or the Jum'ah prayer, that gather Muslims, that gather Tashayyu and followers of the school, Ahlul Bayt, and strengthen and empower them.
Yes.
In terms of their culture, their, let's say, teachings, unity, and also, let's say, understanding better the school of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wasalam. That's why, of course,
yes,
as you rightly mentioned, it was one of the great achievements, mm-hmm, of this great scholar. But beside that, we see that he had lots of great works in fiqh, in kalam, theology, in usul al-fiqh, in philosophy, in logic, in history. Some of them we can mention, that Mir'at al-Uqul fi ilmi al-usul, which is an usuli book.
Yes, this is a famous book.
Right. And the other book, which is very much well known in India, it is Tuhfa-i Isna'ashariya, which was written by Mawlawi Dehlawi against the Shayyo. This,
yes,
book is criticized severely by this great scholar, and he wrote a response to that book, which is again very much a great achievement. Sharh Hadiqatul Muttaqin, which is about fiqh, about taharat, sawm, zakat. The most interesting point is that most of these Indian scholars' works are published in Farsi.
Yes, yes.
In Persian language. It,
yes,
means that at that time, Farsi and Persian was the scientific or the scholarly language of,
uh-huh,
the people.
Yes.
That's why it was published.
You mean
in
even
Farsi.
Among the Shiite scholars,
exactly,
Persian,
yeah,
was welcomed,
yeah,
very
this
much.
This book is Hadiqatul Muttaqin. Is,
yes,
a very, the book that is used by the people, you know, because it is about Tahara, Sawm, Zakat. It shows that majority of the people even know this language, and they were speaking with this language, and they were reading their books in this language.
Yes.
Because it was like Risale Amaliya, like Tawdih al-Masail,
yes,
which was written for the public,
mm-hmm,
in Farsi. That's really, really interesting. And there are some other books like Muntaha al-Afkar fi Usul al-Fiqh. They are the great works of this great scholar in supporting the Usuli school in India.
That's right. Still, the libraries of the Lucknow and the other cities in India are very much rich in terms of the manuscripts. I mean, the Shiite manuscripts, and so many of the scholars from Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon travel to India in order to benefit from the library. Some of the volumes of the manuscripts are found only over there in the Shiite libraries of India. Say Dildar Ali Naqvi, as we said, was the first, that's right, Congregational Sarat leader in the, we can say, Rajab 27th. He led the prayer, the Jum'ah prayer and Salat in Lucknow. He was the first Shiite imam of the Jum'ah prayer in Lucknow. Shaykh Fadai, any other details regarding his life?
Yes, I want to mention that one of the achievements that our scholars, Islamic scholars like Sayyid Dildar Ali Naqvi, they had in their life is to show the real unity of Islamic society.
Yes.
You see that? How they have a connection between India, Iraq, and Iran. Just in order to gain knowledge, he went to Iraq and,
yes,
had some professors there. And then he went to Iran in Mashhad. He used other professors. Then got back to his country, India, and taught there. So this good relationship between three countries just by the subject of knowledge, science of Ahlul Bayt, science of religion. Yes. That is the way that we can have the unity mm-hmm. in our Islamic society.
Very good.
And then the works that he had done, like Namaz al-Jum'ah, Namaz al-Jama'ah, you know, these are, all of them are the symbols of unity of Islamic society,
yes.
which is one of the duties of Islamic scholars that he did very good.
Yes, that's right. Thank you very much. Rajab 19th, 1235, he passed away in the city of Lucknow. His body was taken into Darul Taziyah Cemetery or Hosseiniya and was buried over there. Today, this cemetery is known by the name of Hosseiniya Kufran Ma'ab. We see this is a title given also to Sayyid Dildar Ali Naqvi. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstudy.ir, Call of Islam page. See another episode. God bless you. Fi
لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير
حزن Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: the U.S.'s Israeli genocide, a war on the Gaza Strip, enters its 173rd day, with the death toll approaching 32,500, mostly women and children. Lebanon's Hezbollah fires a barrage of rockets at Israeli targets.